Thanks for tuning in to the Duluth Rundown podcast. We're just about ready for our interview section, but first, a thanks goes out to our sponsor, Austin Jaro Sports. Austin Jaro is located at 1025 West Central Entrance here in Duluth in the Miller Hill Mall area. They have all types of running gear, shoes, clothes, food, and great advice for all types of runners. The store is a key sustainer of the local running scene. They show up and support many Duluth area races and, of course, support this podcast. Thanks, Austin Jaro.
All right, so now we're gonna start our interview section here, our interview part of the podcast. We're going to talk to Mike about his big paddleboard journey. I'm sure a lot of folks have seen, you know, some of the interviews that he's been doing on the news and with the DNT lately, and probably were able to follow you. A lot of folks were able to follow you, Mike, on your website as well, which I'm pulling up now as we speak.
Sure.
Tell us about this, Mike. Tell us about how. First, let's just go back to the beginning. Where did the idea come from?
Yeah. Honestly, I don't really know. I guess I would just credit the depths of the internet to how I found out about this kind of historic paddling route, which is known as the Kruger Waddle Challenge. And so ultimately there's a group of people, part of this paddling kind of community called Water Tribe. Mm-hmm. And they set out every September, and the challenge is to do this route from Shea Shea Resort on Rainy Lake, right on the edge of Voyageurs National Park, west to the Grand Portage, Lake Superior, mm-hmm. in 8 days. And so they kind of pay your way. They collaborate resources to get shuttles and
west or east?
Things like that. East. Did I say west?
Yeah.
Yeah. East. Yeah. Eastward. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. Yeah.
That's all right.
And then link up at the Grand Portage, you know, resort. Yeah. And then on the Sunday, so they start on a Saturday, and then the shuttle is a Sunday. So the challenge is you make it back to get the shuttle.
Right.
Which the route itself is about 250 miles. And so, I mean, you got to crank miles pretty good to make it.
Yeah.
And so it's all different types of canoe teams, you know, three-person, four-person canoes, solo canoes, mainly canoers, and one paddleboard person has finished it. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately I found out about this route and thought it was kind of cool. At the same time, I was thinking about buying a stand-up paddleboard just for fun.
Okay, so that was what I was going to ask. So
yeah.
You knew about this before you even had the paddleboards.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this goes way back.
This goes way back.
Ah,
yeah, several years. And it was just this tiny seed of, like, that's kind of neat, you mm-hmm. know? Like, I had never been in the Boundary Waters one time.
Yeah.
I did one overnight trip one time in October, maybe 2015 or something like that. And a couple of years later, totally just searching the internet. I don't even know how. I just, you know, the depths of the internet.
Yeah, like
follow
rabbit holes.
Rabbit hole. And it's like, oh, that's kind of neat. And at the same time, I wanted to kind of get into paddling. Mm-hmm. I thought of a route, and just looking at, I think, the Duluth city maps, Parks and Rec, you know, there's a lot of paddling options. You know, there's the estuary that really struck my interest. And why I didn't choose, like, a kayak right away, which, mm-hmm. thinking back now, it's like they're so much faster. But
yeah.
But the paddleboard's fun, and ultimately I bought one and just did a couple, like, local routes and did a couple just paddles around the area. And then this idea kind of festered and festered. I found out about a paddleboard doing the border route, the Kruger Waddle Challenge. Mm-hmm. And there's this long YouTube video. Scott Based is his name. Basty, I don't know how to pronounce it. Told me he's from Florida, does all different types of crazy paddling challenges.
Yeah.
This guy from Florida, like Yukon 1,000 Mile.
I think I've seen him before.
All these different types of crazy challenges and races. And
yeah.
There's actually a lot of canoe races out there, like ultra distance, similar. So it's there's like these parallels to the running and hiking kind of world,
yep.
but it's different. It's so interesting. It's like an alternate dimension almost. So anyways, in the last couple years, I guess, I saw Scott's record. This was from 2020. He did a record set it on this established route, you know, 7 days, 10 hours or something. I thought to myself, I could maybe beat that. Mm-hmm. And so then I really put the gears in motion. I purchased a new paddleboard, like a racing style. Like, that's kind of the big next step. And then I kind of set it, like, this year, 2022, mm-hmm. I'm going to go for it. I'm going to put all my eggs in this basket. Mm-hmm. I'm going to secure Boundary Waters permit. And really this year, I just kind of trained all year and did it.
Yeah. Tell us about the logistics of kind of driving up there, like dropping off, like how did the whole thing, how did that, the journey itself get underway?
Yeah. So first of all, it's logistically challenging.
Yeah.
International Falls is maybe what, 3.5 hour drive from Duluth. Mm-hmm. Grand Portage is about 3.5 hour drive from Duluth. Grand Portage to International Falls is about a 3-4 hour drive in between them, like through Ely essentially. So it's all very spread out.
Yeah.
I mean, as the crow flies, the route I took is about as close as a route as you can make, you know?
Right.
And so, and I was kind of loose on exactly what I do. I didn't go with this Water Tribe group, mm-hmm. and I actually didn't even really put it together that they were out there. Like, I knew about it, that they do it every September, but I just kind of picked a date that I thought would work using, like, my vacation hours with the national holiday, Labor Day. Uh-huh. Kind of made sense to me, so I got my permit for that Monday and mm-hmm. just knew that I had to start maybe Sunday or Saturday or maybe Monday mm-hmm. To get to the entry point on the day of my permit.
Okay.
So that was the first kind of logistical challenge, is getting to the edge of the Boundary Waters, which is about 55 miles into the route.
Okay.
By Monday.
Okay.
Technically. I mean, really, is it going to be a big difference if I go in a day earlier, a day late or something like that? Like, no, probably not. But on the flip side, what if a national forest person asked to look at my permit and it was the wrong day or something, you know,
right.
that could be compromised everything, right? Who knows? So anyways, I kind of initially thought that I would just leave my car up there, but this Shea Resort, I mean, it's fairly remote. It's just the resort up there. There's not like a parking mm-hmm. lot, you know, mm-hmm. really. And then I talked to my dad, who really wanted to see both areas, Grand Portage and Voyageurs National Park. He has a kind of travel trailer, can travel around mm. all these spots. And ultimately, I set it up with him that he could meet me at the finish line, drive me back to my car at the start line, so to speak. Mm. So he set that up, and that was kind of like a big relief. Like, okay, to have someone at the finish line, at the finish, you know.
Yeah.
Like, with my backpack, fresh clothes, all that sort of thing. I could stay in his camper, you know, for however long. And it was similar to the challenge of the Water Tribe people, because he said, well, my next reservation is on Sunday, so you just have to make it back by Sunday. Okay. Ultimately, Emily, my girlfriend, and the dogs, we drove up, and she dropped me off at International Falls outside of Shea Resort. So that was nice. I didn't have to leave my car there. Okay. That would be tough. Like, what if I did finish on Sunday, had to make the four-hour drive, then the three-hour drive back?
Yeah.
That would not be fun. So that was really nice. My brother actually drove up my minivan to Grand Portage. And so the logistics actually worked tremendously well, but
nice.
on the backs of my family.
Yeah, no, you kind of almost have to have someone be helping you like that anyway.
Yeah, except unless you're with this Water Tribe group. That's kind of that would tremendously help the logistics.
True.
And you're with this kind of group of like-minded people, which mm-hmm. is really cool. But the logistics, I didn't really have it planned out, but it worked tremendously well, thanks to my family.
What gear did you bring? Gear / food?
Yeah, so really just as lightweight camping gear as possible. I have a lightweight Big Agnes one-person tent, Fly Creek one-person. It's just really ultralight, kind of just sheer, you know, bug netting. Mm-hmm. That worked really well. weight's not as much of a factor as backpacking, but volume is. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of a challenge, I guess. You know, I brought just one change of clothes, kind of like camp clothes and paddling clothes, one change, no wiggle room there. I mean, whatever, you can be in stinky clothes. It's right. The wet clothes that are the issue if your clothes get wet. and then I brought a foam mat plus an inflatable pad, so I slept really kind of Lux.
Yeah.
And that's about it. You know, some kind of survival gear, you know, multi-tool, which I didn't use at all. I never do. You know, some band-aids and tape and things like that. Super glue in case I had any board issues with my tie-downs. Some extra rope and stuff. For food, really, I just scoured the middle of the grocery store, the aisles, for calorie-dense food that would probably last.
Yep.
Potato chips are my number one go-to, you know, cookies, trail mix, gorp, you know, type stuff. One of my favorites is the Knorr pasta sides or the Knorr rice sides.
Yeah.
Those cook up super well,
super fast
on a camp stove.
Yeah.
Plus then I put the tuna in there, so like little tuna packets or salmon or chicken. They have like salmon, chicken, or tuna in these same kind of vacuum steel packets, so
yeah,
that was good. And then I did two kind of more like Trail Fitters, you know, specialty freeze-dried meals as well.
Yep.
Just to mix it up. For lunch, I took a bunch of meat sticks, beef jerky, and cheese. Mm-hmm. Cheese was a mistake.
Oh, really?
I got bad quick. Not bad, but like it was like...
Yeah, and the heat.
Has been warm probably for several days. Do I feel good about eating this?
Yeah.
And then you don't want to risk like getting a stomach ache or something.
Right.
You know, or having to use all my TP, instance.
Right, exactly.
So, other than that, and having thru-hiked the Superior Hiking Trail in kind of a same ultralight fashion, I mean, and a lot of lightweight backpacking, I have a lot of experience and the gear for that. So it was kind of just like, you know, another one. And the thing too is, you know, I did two tester trips throughout the year, one in June, one in July. So I had the chance to shake out my gear. And I guess the biggest concern was on my paddleboard itself.
Mm-hmm.
Do I bring a backup paddle?
I was going to ask that. Yeah.
I didn't know I should or not. And I did.
You did. Okay.
Luckily, I didn't have to use it. But for peace of mind, it was there. And that was nice. But it was kind of a hassle because it's long.
One-piece paddle?
It's a two-piece, but it's still maybe about 3-4 feet long.
Okay.
So it's kind of hanging off the back of my board and turned over, is dragging in the water for a little bit.
It
wasn't great. And then you gotta strap down your gear.
Yeah.
And both times I was in the Boundary Waters early in the year, tie downs snapped off.
Huh.
I tried to epoxy them to my board. They had snapped off both trips.
Yeah.
I did this like marine grade epoxy, and out of 12 tie downs, I only lost one on the long trip.
Okay.
So, and it was towards the later days. But
ultimately,
the gear I took was perfect. If I changed anything, it would maybe be I wouldn't bring a backup paddle, but I don't think that's smart. I wouldn't make a change, I guess. So it worked well. It all worked really well.
Yeah. When you're paddling, so 250 miles, 5 days. How many, what was you were averaging like 50 a day roughly?
Well, I set out thinking with perfect wind conditions, and wind is by far the biggest factor,
right,
in terms of weather or anything. I mean, in bad wind, it can slow you down to zero.
Yeah.
In good wind, you know, like a nice downwind, not too wavy, but maybe 10 miles an hour right at my back, I can cruise at, you know, 5 miles an hour, like pretty good. Totally flat water, maybe that's like 3.5-4 miles an hour, with a slight headwind, you know, or 10 miles an hour headwind, maybe 3 miles an hour. So I mean, that's a pretty big splay if you factor 12 hours on a paddleboard.
Yeah,
3 miles per hour, that's what, 36 hours.
Yeah.
5 miles per hour, that's three times, five 60. Times 12, 60.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big
It's like an entire day.
That's an entire day.
Yeah,
essentially. So I figured if the wind was in my favor the whole time, which would require lots of shifting winds, I mean, the chances of that are almost none, that it's at your back the whole time. But if it was like really good wind conditions, I figure I could do 50 miles per day, and I'd finish on the fifth day. So 4 days, 12 hours or something. I figured I could paddle 14 hours a day, from 5:30 to 7:30. And then ultimately, as it shook out, I did about 42 miles a day and finished on the sixth day. And I didn't make 14 hours a day any of the days. So
So that was, so I know on when I've paddleboarded, you're standing up, and because I've never trained for anything quite like this, so physically I've never been prepared, but your feet get pretty sore standing up. So a lot of times you, especially when it gets wavy too, you're going to get down on your knees and paddle on your knees, or even sit down sometimes and,
yeah,
and paddle while sitting down. One, did you do that? And two, you definitely would be going a lot slower then, because you can, you don't quite get the turn on the paddle if you're lower on the board.
Yeah, I found that I definitely generated the most amount of power and speed standing up.
Yeah.
And I mean, I trained to be standing up, and I could last all day standing up, no sweat.
You were okay 12 hours or so standing the whole time?
Yeah, definitely, okay, definitely. Nice. And what was nice too is that the wind, although it wasn't optimal, it was good enough where I didn't have to sit down a lot.
Nice.
And so that allowed me to kind of keep my speed. In terms of the feet, yeah, they didn't get sore, but one toe on my left foot was constantly numb. And to this day, it's still numb.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of get that on my feet when I paddleboard for just like an hour or so.
I think it helped to have shoes on.
So I was going to ask about that. On some of the pictures I saw, you had your trail shoes on.
Yeah.
Was that for portages, or what was the reason?
Yeah. Everything. I mean, on one...
Well, of course, camping too, but...
Yeah, for one, for sure the portages, but for two, I just feel like it's a little more comfortable to have them on versus be barefoot.
And you wore them the whole time you were paddling?
The whole time, yep.
Interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a couple of afternoons I took them off, especially in the sun, like maybe they'll dry, but...
Sure.
They were soaking wet for 6 days straight, and then I threw them in the trash.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I'm not wearing these again. No. I'd rather spend $120 to get fresh ones than wear these stinking shoes again.
Yeah. Yeah. What were some of the low points of the trip?
The low points, you know, the first couple days, I guess I was a little bit concerned. First of all, just on the mileage, but also just on my body holding up. Mm-hmm. By day four, I stopped being sore, which was nice. So there weren't really many low points the first 4 days. It was all pretty nice. I guess on the third day, I made the least amount of miles. I didn't broach 40. It's pretty windy. I mean, not super windy, but it's just in my face almost all day.
Yeah.
And then I had a bunch of portages that day. I jumped in the lake after the long basswood portage. It's about a mile long, which was nice. I figured that I could dry my shirt before I got to camp. And then halfway to camp from there, I hit a rock and fell in. Went overboard, and my board flipped over, and my bungee gear was just totally underwater.
Yeah.
I kind of freaked out. Luckily, then I just stood up, and I'm in waist-deep water, you know, and just right in my board. But that was kind of crummy. It's just like, ah, nuts. My shirt's wet. It's not, you can't dry out your shirt until you get into the sun. I mean, in 7 p.m., sun's below the horizon. It's not drying out.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. So that was kind of a low point. I had some kind of just, in the mornings, were rough, you know, because like my hands got progressively more sore and just like my body creaky, and waking up was harder. And then I kind of just had, you know, you're by yourself, like these tiny things just really are like majorly concerning to you, you know, at a certain point, just being out by yourself in the woods. The morning dew.
Yeah.
Like my sleeping bag when I would wake up would be just kind of damp, and it started to really concern me. Like, how is this going to dry out? What am I going to do tonight?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then you get to camp that night. It's like, it's literally not an issue
at all.
But then the next morning, it's like, oh, it's wet. What am I going to do? What am I possibly going to do here? It's slightly damp. Like, okay, settle down. So there are a couple just like minor, you know, low points, but that's really nothing. Definitely the low point was the last day, which was extremely challenging. As I set it up, I had about a 10-mile paddle on the remaining two lakes. Let's see, Moose Lake and then North and South Fowl Lake. And then it's essentially the eastern end of the boundary waters. My map cut out. I had plotted it out just on Google Maps on a mapping app that it was about a 12-mile river run on the Pigeon River, 12 miles to Grand Portage. So, I mean, this is an established route. I figured that the Pigeon River was, like, smooth sailing.
Yeah.
But it really was low. It was really not runnable at all.
Huh.
And so when I made the first mile in 58 minutes, I realized that the additional 11 miles were going to be pretty slow going.
A long time, yeah.
I was hoping I could do 4 miles an hour down river. And I did 1 mile in 1 hour. And so, you know, you start running math and it's like, am I going to be doing the Grand Portage in the dark?
Yeah.
Because there's that 12 miles and then 8.5 mile Grand Portage.
Wow.
So the last day, oh man, I didn't know what to expect. My map cut out. I saw like this big old stone dam. It looked pretty cool. And I wondered if there was a portage because it was clearly like rapids below the dam, not to mention the dam itself. There is one. It's on the Canadian side. My map didn't show it just because it cut off, so I didn't really know where to go. Luckily, my GPS watch, I could kind of see where to go, but I there wasn't a portage.
Yeah.
So I just went over the dam, and I was on these slippery rocks kind of sideways, and just with my board in my arm. And, I mean, it was just that first mile was really slow. Ultimately, I made it down to the river itself, but it was too shallow. I couldn't run it.
Yeah.
I thought about taking off my fin, but I didn't want to stop.
Yeah.
So I was just walking down the river.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine just walking down a creek or a river, you know, ankle deep water, slippery rocks, clearing a board. I got all my stuff on my back. Rocks started filling up my shoes. They're sharp rocks.
Yeah.
And then that day was a pouring rain, 50 degrees, just a drenching rain.
Yeah.
I had sunshine for 5 days, day six, drenching rain. And so I could feel that my shirt was getting wet underneath and started getting cold.
Underneath like a rain jacket?
Underneath my rain jacket, yeah.
Yeah.
And my battery on my watch, which was I was relying on, started running down, you know, and like, Mike, you idiot, you could have charged this all night last night to 100%, and I figured 50% would be enough, and it was at like 20%, 1 mile in an hour, what's two going to be? And I figured, okay, it looked like it was kind of narrow, like rapids on my map for 2 miles, and then, so I hope that 10 miles would be, it would widen out, and then after 2 miles of just trudging in the rain, it did widen out. Oh. Wonderful.
So you could run that.
So I put my board in, and it was just kind of like a normal river.
Okay.
You know, no rapids. You couldn't even feel the current, really. It didn't seem like. Well, half mile down, more rapids. So I tried to run through them, and I just totally smashed up my board. I mean, my fin was hitting rock after rock after rock. At that point, I was like, I don't even care if I can make it down.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do with your gear? You know, do I keep it strapped on? No, I just kept it on my back.
Yeah.
Then my shoulders were killing it. I knew I had this 8.5 mile portage.
And you're kind of top heavy.
Yeah, so you can't stand up.
Right.
You know, you can't stand up with the stuff on your back.
Yeah.
Luckily, my food bag was small enough it could fit in my normal bag at that point, which is like a 35-liter dry bag with shoulder straps.
Yeah.
So it was just, that was really a struggle. At a certain point, I could see on my watch that the Border Route Trail, hiking trail, kind of paralleled the river.
Okay.
And so at a certain point, I was just so sick of just trudging down the river in ankle-deep, shin-deep water, uneven. You know, just the river was rushing and, you know, it's just slippery, sharp, uneven rock. It's just terrible. I'm just walking with my board, drenching rain. It was just absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, that does not sound fun.
Day one, I would have bailed.
Yeah.
No question. But it's just like, I've come this far.
Yeah.
You know, I have 10 more miles, 18 more miles maybe. Then that you think of that too, like 18 more miles just carrying my board.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Right.
It's like a marathon.
Right.
Carrying my board.
Yeah. In the pouring rain.
In the pouring rain.
Through rocky, slippery rocks.
I'm cold.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I took a hard right into the woods, and I just bushwhacked through dense forest, thinking this might be the end of me or something. But I found the Border Route Trail, and I walked the Border Route Trail maybe about a half mile, and got back on the river, and I could paddle, and it's great. And then it was just that sequence over and over, like paddle a mile of kind of rapids and schlepping my board over slippery rocks.
At this point, you knew where the Border Route Trail was back and forth, though? You were able to get back on the trail? Or just that
one? No, I did one little stretch,
just one time.
And then I'm back on. And then the Border Trail goes off to the overlook.
Kind of turns away.
270-degree overlook.
Okay.
Which that was kind of cool, though, knowing, like, hey, to my right is where the Superior Hiking Trail starts. Like, that's kind of, I mean, and the scenery was still amazing, you know. It's cool to think of all these people, and that's what I thought of, you know, out there. Like, think of these six-man canoe teams with 2,000 pounds of beaver pelts trying to run this. What do they do? You know?
Yeah.
So
they
that
did
was
the same thing. They just walked through through the rain and junk. Yeah.
Yeah. So I could have stopped. I could have charged my watch. I could have put on my taken off my fin. Mm-hmm. Those things would have helped. But I didn't want to stop in the rain. I was kind of afraid of hypothermia, honestly, because I was getting really cold.
Yeah, you want to keep moving.
I want to keep moving. Yeah. And I told myself, like, keep moving and generate heat. Keep moving and generate heat. So that was definitely the low point. Pigeon River was utterly horrendous.
You know what that is? That's a symbolic baptism that you just went through. In literature and television, movies and stuff like that, when the hero, oftentimes you'll see the hero, maybe we've talked about this before, you'll see the hero like get pushed into a pool, or they'll be out in the rain, or they'll jump into a lake or something like that when they're going through a rough time. And then they have that, what's called the symbolic baptism occurs. And then after that, their situation starts to change. So that's kind of what it was. It sounds like for you towards the end of your trip.
My situation did not change until Lake Superior.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't get easier. In fact, it got harder physically on the Grand Portage. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was just like, I just want to get this done. And I'm running it. And I ran it in.
Nice.
The Water Tribe people were saying to my mom, apparently, that I would do it in 4 hours. And the fastest time that anyone had done it in their group was 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And I did it in 2 hours and 15 minutes. So that was just excruciating pain, you know, just trying to carry my board. And just like,
you just switch arms.
Yeah, constantly switch arms. In fact, it was like, if I can make it to that tree, I can switch arms. And then I make it to this tree, and like, I can do a little bit more. I can do a little bit. But if I can get to that tree, I'm definitely switching arms.
This could be a new event at the Ely race where they have the canoe marathon.
Yeah.
Paddleboard marathon.
Yeah, count me out.
Yeah.
Count me out. Not interested.
All right. So that sounds like a definite low point.
Yeah.
No question. It's about as low as it gets. Fortunately, it kind of occurred at the end. But what were some of the high points?
Yeah. I would think at the end of each day, especially really every day I camped was a high point to make it to camp. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, just every day it's like, wow. I might need just 45 miles.
Have camps set up, or did you just find one?
So in the Boundary Waters, you camp pre whatever assigned campsite.
Right.
So you can't book them.
Oh, it's first come, first serve?
It's first come, first serve. You can't book them.
Oh, okay.
You cannot book them.
Okay.
It's first come, first serve.
Okay.
So I really lucked out because in June and July, doing some tester ones, I had some anxiety-provoking moments trying to find a late night campsite. Not really late night, but it was just like, I'm done paddling.
Yeah.
I'm stopping at this campsite. I couldn't find it. You know, I'll go to the next one. Can't find that one. Go to the next one. Oh, there's people here. Go to the next one. People here. People here. People here. And finally, you know, like if that happens, you know, and I'm like pushing the envelope on time, that could be like really unpleasant.
Right.
But I really lucked out. So like to find sweet campsites literally 5 nights in a row was a high point. And then just to like be done, and like I go in the lake, I had a couple like just amazing bonfires. And again, the first five days were no rain, beautiful sunshine, awesome sunsets. I would say the high point really though was on day three. I had a low day, kind of wind in my face. My tracker had a weather functionality, so I could request weather forecasts for essentially like 36 hours into the future. And I knew with that windy day, I knew it was coming. Mm-hmm. But I also knew the next day, day four, was supposed to be like light winds, tailwind. Mm-hmm. I'm heading northeast. The winds were supposed to be 4 miles an hour southwest.
Southwest, like, yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And so, ultimately that day I got onto, Birch Lake and Knife Lake. And those are kind of long, skinny lakes that run, southwest, northeast. Mm-hmm. And they were glass.
Okay.
Just utter glass for miles and hours and hours and hours. And so that was just so fun. Just prime conditions.
Yeah.
No wind whatsoever. It's a slight tailwind, but just like the glassy water was so fun.
I saw one of the pictures. Yeah. I don't know if it was in the DNT link or one of the TV links, but there's the front of your board and just Yeah, smooth water is really cool. Smooth water,
yeah, and that helps a lot of things too, because if it's wavy, you can't see rocks as much. Mm-hmm. I was pretty sensitive to rocks after falling off the day before, and so just on flat water and like nice sun, you can see those rocks easily. I just had just optimal travel conditions on that fourth day, and I made good time, you know, almost 50 miles. So.
Did you have polarized glasses?
I didn't bring sunglasses.
No sunglasses at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever use those?
I'm not a big sunglasses user.
Those are nice for water, though.
Yeah. They probably would have helped a lot.
You know, you're seeing down into the water a little better.
Yeah. They probably would have helped a lot. Not to mention just the squinting, but... Yeah.
This is a little sidetrack. Do you use sunglasses when you ride, though?
No.
No? You don't ride with glasses either?
No. I like white or just clear construction glasses, honestly.
Sure.
Yeah. I use those for, like, cycling.
Yeah. That's what I would assume. Yeah. So overall, what were your thoughts then on the trip?
Overall, it was incredibly fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think the one thing that I can think of is, you know, it was really a hell of a trip. Mm-hmm. It was really fun kind of planning for it and kind of delving into this other world, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
I think something that I was looking for is to push my limits physically, you know, that's how I get my jollies, I guess, but also emotionally and mentally.
It's a whole different thing. I would think that's a solo journey. Well, you did it with the thru hike.
Yeah.
So you had that experience, but not a lot of us have had that kind of experience of a real true solo journey like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really do think I push my limits in all three categories, mentally, physically, and emotionally. So, you know, I guess I ticked a lot of boxes doing that, you know, kind of from an ego standpoint. I wanted to break Scott's record.
Sure.
What's funny is that I kind of figured that he'd be out there. Mm-hmm. I heard when I was out there, oh, we haven't seen a paddleboarder except yesterday. Mm-hmm. And now it's 2 days in a row, we see another paddleboarder. I heard that all the time.
Yeah.
Like, was that like an older guy looking like he was moving fast? Like, I don't know. You know, so I didn't get a real sense. Right. I was like, that's maybe Scott. So Scott beat his own record.
Oh, nice.
By like a lot. A day and a half, really.
Okay.
And so his original record was 7 days, 10 hours. He did 6 days, 5 hours.
Okay.
And then 6 hours after he made it to Lake Superior, I broke that record with 5 days, 10 hours. So that was another cool thing, you know, to meet my goal. I wanted to beat the record. I thought I could do under 5 days, but on the sixth day, I was definitely satisfied.
Yeah.
So ultimately really fun, and I don't think there's any real downsides. I guess I do have maybe some lingering nerve issues.
Yeah, that'll come back though.
I think that'll come back.
Yeah
no problem. And I can always get the surgery. No, I'm just kidding. But
what's next?
I don't know. I got nothing.
Yeah.
I got nothing.
Let the inspiration hit.
Yeah.
You can go down another rabbit hole on the internet and find something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to keep paddling. I love paddling.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, it's been so fun to open up that different world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where we live, Duluth, Minnesota, is a mecca.
You know, Apostle Island stuff.
Apostle Islands.
Yeah.
There's a state water trail. Actually, there's three state water trails right in the area.
Okay.
The Lake Superior water trail that goes from Grand Portage to Duluth along the Lake Superior shore.
Cool.
There's the St. Louis River.
Oh, yeah.
There's the Cloquet River.
Okay.
Those are all state water paddling trails.
Oh, nice.
Also, there's a national water trail right here in Duluth. It's the St. Louis River Estuary that's recently designated as a national water trail.
Okay.
So that's kind of neat because we have two nationally designated trails right here in Duluth.
Yeah.
With the North Country Trail, Superior Hiking Trail, and now the St. Louis River Estuary. So as a runner and paddler, there's a lot of cool options. And, I don't know if I'd do anything like that again. All the Water Tribe folks were pretty eager to encourage me to come back with the group and things, and on one hand it could definitely be done faster. Absolutely. I can do it faster. I can do it faster next week. I think.
Yeah With a little know-how or a little luck or
just the willingness to go through the night, stay up all night. Sacrifice sleep.
Yeah, at least one or two nights.
Yeah.
You know, even if need be. Yeah. Yeah.
It's easily sacrifice sleep.
Okay.
To make up time, but it's scary.
I was going to say, so I want to ask about paddling at night, which is I've never done even in kayaking. I've never ever paddled at night. Obviously, you would need some sort of a headlamp, right?
Not necessarily, no.
If it's a bright moon, you just go on. You're okay.
Yeah,
I've never done it, so I really don't know.
Yeah.
Attach a headlight to your front of your board.
And this is even during the day, you know, you're out there and there are so many islands and points and different shorelines. You know, there could be a island that's 3 miles across and it's 5 miles straight ahead. And then the shoreline behind it is 12 miles back. You know, some of these big lakes, Saginaga or Lac La Croix, you know, a lot of big lakes, Rainy Lake. You can't even see the features of the land. It just looks like a landmass, right? So even in the bright day, it's hard to navigate. You can't pick out a point and say, that's the point I need to get to.
So the headlamp wouldn't matter because you're only illuminating like 10 feet in front of you, and that's kind of meaningless.
Yeah, it's totally meaningless.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to go 12 miles.
Gotcha.
And so... And your eyes adjust enough, unless it's like a totally pitch black night, you can see the tree line anyways. And really it's just paddling on a bearing.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of it too. It's not a lot of like navigation on this route.
Okay.
I mean, it's interesting because the border is kind of in its position for a reason. And it's this shared waterway that's been used for really centuries. You know, it's kind of the least amount of portages to canoe, you know, birch bark canoes in the history.
Right.
And so like this route is a lot of open water paddling and limited as little as possible portaging.
Yeah.
So ultimately, you know, to get to A to B, you can pick a bearing like east, due east. And there are stretches where it's just like 20 miles due east.
Do you use a compass?
I didn't. Talking to some of these water tribe people, the true spirit of the challenge is that you don't use any GPS.
Yeah.
You know, you can have it, of course, and everyone did, I think, but, to use really just a compass and a map, which I did not use. I use my watch. My watch has a compass on it. I had a, you know, physical compass, but I left it in my bag. But ultimately, yeah, it's I think completely feasible to travel at night. In fact, it might be easier because of the waves.
Sure. Oh yeah, because the wind dies down.
Wind dies down
at nighttime. Yeah, so
generally, so
I was just thinking, you know, you're talking about like the people who establish this route. Imagine, how do you even do that? How do you establish, you tell your, oh, you get to that island, you're going to need to bear right a little bit, you know, and then that goes on for like 250 miles and it's like a conversation with other people. And maybe you write it down somehow and remember it. Basically, you remember the route in your head, essentially.
I think anyone out there who hasn't been to Grand Portage should make a trip because there's so much history.
I've been through it once, but we stopped real quick. But
yeah, through Thunder Bay or whatever.
Yeah.
There's so much history. I mean, it's a national monument. So it talks a lot about voyagers and the fur trade, but also indigenous people. And, you know, there's the... reservation, you know, the band, you know, indigenous people live there, and their ancestors really probably have been doing this for centuries, hundreds and thousands of years, really.
Yeah.
And so back then, I mean, they didn't have maps at all.
Right.
It's all storytelling and just passed on knowledge.
Right.
And I mean, that is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And people, I mean, indigenous people would do the whole 250 miles and beyond. You know, they go up to Lake Winnipeg.
Yeah.
I mean, to follow the food and the resources, right? And that's strictly by memory.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really fun. The history, that was something that I kept thinking about is the history. I'm thinking about the people who have come before me. And I mean, it's relatively unchanged.
Yeah.
You know, even from the standpoint of campsites, they didn't have cast iron metal grates and latrines. But I mean, I have to assume these sites have been utilized for...
That's why they're there now.
Right.
Yeah.
Why would they change?
Yeah. Right?
If it's a good spot, nice flat clearing and a good landing for a boat, why would you go anywhere else?
Yeah, exactly.
I found that to be just fascinating.
And probably a lot of those campsites weren't necessarily like created by man. They were just, this is a perfect location that's naturally occurred, so we will utilize it.
Right.
You know, they didn't chop down trees and flatten out the ground or anything.
No.
They just utilized what was already there.
Right. And I think that's kind of the indigenous, you know, motto, so to speak, is that, you know, the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
And so I think with campsites, you know, this like the path of least resistance, where can we stay that's naturally good, but also just the route itself, you know, this is the path of least resistance to get from Lake Superior to Rainy Lake and beyond. You know.
How would it be to traverse that in the opposite direction?
I don't know. I will say water flows west the vast majority of the time.
West or east?
West.
Away from Lake Superior?
Yeah.
Yep. Interesting.
Yep. Yep. The vast majority.
Huh.
Even I think through like Gunflint Lake, which is like mile 200 out of 250, you know, if you go west to east, I'm pretty sure that was flowing still towards Rainy Lake, Lake of the Woods, Lake Winnipeg, that way. There's the Laurentian Divide, I believe, is what splits it.
Yeah.
And Pigeon River.
It must angle up a little bit.
It angles up. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have expected that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you pass a lot of portages that are next to rapids or falls. And, I mean, they're all flowing back. But I think what's the benefit, though, is, you know, even like a somewhat flowing river, wind is a bigger factor.
Yeah.
So,
the
trade winds, so to speak,
right.
I think generally are from the west
to
pushing
east. Yeah, exactly.
Generally.
Yep.
And so I think that's why the water tribe group does it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And plus there's just something, I think it would be challenging because there's a lot more portaging on the back end.
That would make sense. That would make sense it would make sense that you utilize the wind more so than the flow, unless it was like a really obviously a strong current. But man, I'm surprised. I would just have assumed that the water goes from Rainy Lake to Lake Superior.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah. That's cool. That's super cool. I mean, I knew about the Laurentian Divide and everything. I just didn't know it's where its location, especially that far up.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Well, a pretty awesome journey, Mike. I know a lot of folks were, I know, even in my training group, people were talking about it. So that they saw you in the interviews and stuff. So congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Yeah. And look forward to hearing whatever's next.
Yeah. Maybe nothing.
All right, that then wraps up our latest episode, episode number 53 of the Duluth Rundown podcast. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in all over the world, and I want to thank Mike for sharing his awesome journey with us. Super cool to hear that, and we'll talk to you guys in a couple of 3 weeks.